Concession number 14806, Eddie Murray, reel 10.
Right. What did the pay and conditions vary in each of these organisations?
I'm afraid I never...
No.
I feel absolutely certain that... Well, I know for a fact, of course, that those in the Legion was entirely apart from them and worse paid until, I would think... No, I went out 41. Somewhere in the region, probably in about 41, 42. First of all, there was a supplement that the Legion got once they were out in foreign climes.
Mm-hmm.
Once we left North Africa, there was a supplement for the Far East, for instance.
Mm. Okay.
And then I know that somewhere during, you know, the 40s, somewhere about the 40s, that the Legion pay was put on the same standard as the regular army.
Right. What about the colonial infantry? I was there a professional regular army element of the colonial troops?
Oh yes, yes.
What were they? What there must have been a particular sort of person that wanted to join that sort of organisation. That they would only serve outside of France?
No. Don't think so.
No.
I'm sure that they were. I suppose they were in a position to ask for whatever regiment they wanted, but most of the time, being the colonial army called up, you see, apart from the professionals who were there or who decided to stay on and who made it their their life work, if you like. But I'm sure that the others were, you know, sent and went where they were sent.
Okay. Right. Those who are in the volunteered regular army simply to serve overseas
I don't think that existed at all.
Mm-hmm.
No. I don't think that any of them could have asked for that unless they were in Indochina and called up in Indochina. And I suppose they could specify that because their parents and their future jobs, for instance, was in Indochina or were in Indochina, that they could specify that they really wanted to serve in Indochina.
What were the people in the actual the French overseas civilians? What were they like to deal with?
Oh well, of course they were more or less like the Brits were in the time of the Raj in India. You know, they were a population unto themselves. They didn't mix too freely with locals unless those locals were of the administration or came into the realms of the jobs in which they themselves were working. Like if they were employees in the bank and one of them made manager or deputy or under manager or something like this, or head clerk, then of course he would be allowed to mix probably with the European manager or European directors. And if they were in a firm, of course, I suppose it would be reasonable to suppose that if the man was important enough, then he could join with the Europeans.
Yep.
Otherwise, he was just left.
Right. And how did they mix with, for instance, the people like yourself or the French army, the ordinary army? I mean, were they?
Army life in the Legion, you see, was always disciplined, and you didn't have much free time.
No. Okay.
I was something and very, very much apart. I mean, I remember going to a wedding in Hanoi, where I'd been forbidden to go by the acting colonel of the regiment, who was the battalion commander of the 1st Battalion, Lagarigue. And I'd put in a report, and he was acting colonel, asking to go to the wedding of one of the pupils from the school, one of my English pupils, do you see, Lergenmüller or Herzenmüller, no, Lergenmüller. And the answer came back to say, no, no way. You see, and so I was I got myself dressed up in a brand new suit, as a matter of fact, in a sort of a shantung, white, creamy white, and white shoes and all the rest of it, you see. And I was entitled to dress up as a civilian because I was an NCO. NCOs could go about into town with in civilian clothes. Uh-huh. And so I went there, and the first person, of course, who was there in the hallway of the hotel where the marriage was taking place was Lagarie.
Oh, right.
Who looked at me. You see, he was on the reception committee. I don't know how. But, I know, he was in the foyer, and the bride introduced me to him as Monsieur Murray, you see. And he looked at me and he said, I feel sure we've met before. And I said, well, you know, that's very possible somewhere. But, I mean, he...
But was he in a good humour, really? Or?
No,
he's in a very bad humour.
But he you know...
He wasn't going to make an issue of it.
He'd never seen me in civilian clothes. You see, he'd always seen me in the, you know, in Legion clothes.
Yeah.
And so, then, of course, I wasn't going to stop to answer any of his inquiries. I know we had a wonderful time at the wedding, and then Lerken Müller, his wife, was in the administration in Hanoi. And then he, when the Japanese attacked us on the just before the attack, he was an aviator at Kim Dae. Mm. And they had a bet on these aviators. They used to fly Potes, you know, 1916 models. And they had a bet on. Kim Dae was sort of like this compared to the surrounding land. It was a plateau. And this was a landing field. And they had a monthly bet on to see who could land the closest to the perimeter. And he misjudged it, and his wheels caught on the actual perimeter, do you see, on the stones, or the rock, shall we say, here. And of course he turned over and he was sent to the hospital, Lanesson Hospital in Hanoi, where he was found by the Japanese when they attacked on the 9th of March, and he was tortured to such an extent that he died of his wounds. And so there is my friend Ted, and one of my girlfriends, of course, a widow. And they moved back to Paris, and I had her.
Shall we move back to the build-up to the attack by the Japs?
Oh, if you like.
Okay.
there was no build-up because it
just
came
happened,
as a surprise.
Right. I was going to ask you. What were the French, the attitude of the French, in brief, the attitude of the French colonials to other people who weren't French colonials? I think we've covered the attitude largely to the native population, but I mean to people who were they rather stand up?
Well, to the French colonials, you see, there you're sitting in a place which is hot, you see, just like in India.
Mm.
And like in India, you've got the Pankawala.
Mm.
You see, in Indochina, you also had the... golly, I had it just a minute ago. The boys, do you see, who pulled the... who caused the ventilation, shall we say?
Yes.
Pulled the... Kikwan.
The fan.
Oh, dear. Well, yes. Mm. They pulled these things, the Pankas, you know, just like in India, and caused the ventilation. Well... when you've got people like that and running around with the char boys, you know, tea and souping up and serving you drinks and things like this, it's automatic, I think, that you treat all the natives in the same manner, unless you know for a fact that they are not of that category, but of a superior category, like in administration or even school teachers, school masters, heads of schools, perhaps, would come into a recognizable category.
Mm.
And then as far as the military were concerned, of course, we didn't meet up with them very, very often. And we always, unless you were an officer, then you had to be in civilian clothes to sort of mix with them.
Was there a class of people, as there are in certain other places, where they were entirely Frenchified Vietnamese, who perhaps, you know, they're in more on the French net than they are on the on their local net. But
no, I don't think still they were on Indochina, mm-hmm. because there was always, well, from 1941 when I was there, there's no doubt about it that already the movement to towards independence, you see, was mm-hmm. rife among the Indochinese people, and they resented the presence of foreign troops and French mm-hmm. up to a point. They realized also that they had to learn everything like the Japanese did, to learn everything that the European was doing in order that they could take over when eventually independence, which they were quite sure was coming, arrived. But there was also another category which was very, very much evident in Indochina, were the Métis that I called before,
yes, yes.
who are half French and half Indochinese.
Yes.
And they themselves, of course, did their best to get into the French, I feel, mm. into the French category.
But they weren't accepted so much.
But they weren't always accepted.
Mm. But by their own people also.
But by their own people, of course, they were not accepted. No. Just like the half-caste in India.
Uh-huh. Okay.
They were sort of a category on their own.
Right.
But for the most part, I think that the French were prepared to accept them mm. with limitations. Mm. And so they were allowed into the, provided they dressed as Europeans, they could go into European places.
Mm.
But if they kept to the Indo-Chinese mode of dressing,
mm.
then they found it much more difficult.
Mm. Was there actual discrimination, you know, on dress, or could, I mean, if even though the man had enough money to buy a meal and he turned up at a restaurant not properly dressed, or you could say not in here, chum.
No. I don't think it was as bad mm. as it was in India mm. or in South Africa.
Yeah. Okay. Now, were there any Japs around where you were in Viet Rhee? Yes.
In Viet Rhee, there were Japs within a couple of miles. They had an encampment there.
And so for what strength?
Hundreds rather than thousands.
Right.
The main barracks, of course, of the Japanese were in Hanoi. They had quarters in Hanoi.
Right. And were they in the field, or were they, you know, in field conditions, or were they in a barracks, or billeted, or what?
They wouldn't have, no, they didn't have barracks. They had logement. They had quarters, you know. They probably built them themselves, or had them built by the native mm. population.
So what?
On payment, because they kept themselves to themselves.
So you know, what does that mean? Permanent
hutments.
Hutments. Mm. Sorry?
Hutments. Like we've got at Fox Hill. We have hutments that were put up, you know, for 10 years, but are still there. They were put up in 40.
Okay. So they were permanent huts.
And they had, there were lots and lots of tents.
All right.
They had their own tents as
so
well.
So a sort of, well, cantonment,
yes.
That sort of thing.
Cantonment, mm. yeah.
And I mean,
and they did exercises, you know, from, you know, one could go out there, or if one was passing, which you didn't really want to do.
No, exactly. Well, I was going to come on to that. Yeah. Yeah. No, please tell me,
but they
if
did,
you were passing.
They did lots and lots of physical training.
PT.
You know, PT, yes.
Mm.
Lots and lots of it.
Mm.
But they didn't, they always, there was always a group, at least, or a section at least. You know, wherever they were, if they were patrolling, there would still be about 30 of them, between 24 to 30 of them as a patrol. And I never did see any of them in company size.
And how far away were they from you, these?
No, they patrolled Tong and Viet Rhee. They patrolled the various places.
And I mean,
but I mean, they were on route marches, shall we say.
Right.
See, they had that excuse. But they were, there was all. They were always. You had a one had a feeling that they were just checking up on the where the military were.
Mm. Okay. What? How far away were they from you physically? I mean, kilometers, a few, 3 miles or 2 miles?
Oh, a couple of miles. A
couple
miles,
of miles, right. I mean, you must have bumped into them occasionally yourself.
Oh yes, yes.
I mean, what sort of?
Just, you know. We'd been instructed not to cause any trouble. And so if they were marching up on the right-hand side, then we went across to the left-hand side.
And, I mean, was there exchange of compliments of people
never,
saluting officers?
Never.
Really?
So in the... In Hanoi, I know that they took part in, like, the 14th of July.
The Japs took part
The Japs took part in that. But in a very inoffensive manner, you know, and...
Or their own parade uniform?
In parade uniform. Really? And they would have officers with the French officers.
Really? And...
You know, taking the salute.
And did they, I mean, do you know whether they mix socially? I mean, all these colonial...
There are two
levels. One is formally, that I mean, you know, if there's a reception at the residence...
Solely formally, never socially.
Ah.
Never ever. No, that would be... No, they didn't mix. Ah. Not socially. And yet, I mean, they used the same bars and things like this. You know, but they wouldn't drink together. If I were in a if I were an officer in whatever bar in an hotel, shall we say, in Hanoi, drinking and sitting down with colleagues at a table,
Did you go to Hanoi very often, or
no?
Oh right, but okay, yes.
No. But I wouldn't invite them to drink, not to have a drink. And what's more, you know, they. Yes, they did drink beer. One could see them drinking beer. But for the most part, they had their own drinks.
Sake and
things like that.
And you bumped into them in the town. You know, if you're in a place, a small place, and there's another unit there, and inevitably your blokes are going down doing errands, or they're actually on official business... buying something that they can't get through the military system, or buying stamps for people or something, and soldiers from different units and different nationalities bump into each other. You see vehicles, maybe they didn't have that many vehicles, but I mean they're bumping into each other.
I think they take precautions that if the Japanese came to a market, for instance, and saw that there were a number of Lin Tai, French troops there, whether they were Legion or Colonial or Artillery, that they would either wait or go to some other place.
I see.
And the same thing, if we saw that the Japs were there first, if it was the Legion, I think 9 times out of 10, we'd have carried on with our job, with our duties. But as far as the Colonial troops are concerned, I'm quite sure that they'd been issued with very, very stern instructions to avoid any confrontation.
And what impression did you gain of the Japs, having seen them?
I had a preconceived idea of the Japs, that I hated their guts. And, you know, I mean, this was something that we all knew, you know, that they were heathens, and they were bandits and robbers and murderers, and didn't follow our rules and regulations concerning chivalry or gallantry or, you know, gentlemanness, if you like. They were not European, and so they were the lowest of the low. And we knew that they were this. This was a preconceived idea. Mm. And we never mixed with them sufficiently for any of us to change the opinion that we had of them.
What did you, if you saw them, either in their camps or in groups around, I mean, just by the way that they moved around, etc., I mean, what did you make of them? I mean, bewilderment, bemused?
But we didn't go to those places.
Right.
We used to, we saw them training.
Mm. What did you make of...
And then that they were absolutely disciplined. That everything that they did was coordinated and ordered by a superior. And we knew for a fact, having heard stories, I suppose, out there, that if a Japanese soldier put his foot wrong, then, and I mean, we had all seen it, that if a Japanese soldier put a foot wrong or seemed to be doing something that in the eyes of his superior officer or NCO was wrong, then the whip was there, you know, and the NCOs and the officers used to carry these sort of, yes, whips, like a horse whip, you know, that we, with not with a lash on the end, but with a length of leather, and this would be used.
So they'd want here to hit him across the
face, across the hands, across the arms, you know. Mm. And the you know, when the Japanese the soldier would kowtow and
bow,
yes.
Keep bowing, yeah.
You could see that they were disciplined, and they knew that if they put a foot wrong, then they were in for real trouble. And I wouldn't have been surprised, you know, if they'd been shot, you know, for putting a foot wrong, and if they were in camp and if a weapon was available.
Mm. What did you make of them on patrol? I mean, did they look as if they knew where they were?
They didn't look sloppy. They never looked sloppy. Yeah. They were always correctly dressed, but in battle dress, but they didn't have anything that shone, like we would have polished boots and all that sort of thing. They were in canvas sneakers, if you like. And the remarkable thing was, and I think at a time we copied it afterwards, were these boots that they had, with just a big toe, and then the rest of the boot was.
Canvas.
Just the big toe was for the had one compartment, and the four toes had their own compartment together. Do you see? And so it was like a mitten. The boots that they wore were like mittens.
Right, and they were canvas.
The rubber soled.
Rubber soled, and the rest were canvas. Yes, I see.
And these, you know, where they were proven, and I read stories afterwards how this assisted the climbing of trees and mountains and things like that. And I can well believe it.
Did they seem as if they're on another planet? I mean, compared, you know, if I can put it as a bit of a sort of
journalistic question. Us, and they didn't want to know us, but I'm sure that each and every one of them, you see, was keeping his eyes open, and probably when they returned to their parade quarters or headquarters, that, you know, they were asked to report what they'd seen and what they hadn't seen.
Okay.
This was the impression that one got when seeing a section or a patrol.
modern equipment for the time?
Much more modern than ours, of course. Mm. They had their, you know, typical Japanese hats. But everything was in khaki, and their you know, we were taught what the epaulettes meant,
badges
of rank. This was one of the things we were taught in order that we wouldn't put a foot wrong. If we were a sergeant, then we weren't going to take orders from sergeants, or you know, because there were occasions, of course, when this sort of thing had to be known. We had to know it, whether we were addressing a captain or a colonel.
Did that happen, or when did that happen?
You know, remember. I'm sure it did happen, but I can't remember on what occasion.
What was the attitude of the blokes to the Japs in the Legion and the French Army at that time?
Similar to mine, of course, that they were, shall we say, not to be disturbed. That they were bastards, if you like, the whole race. You know, and we must treat them as being very, very dangerous.
So quite
wary of them, yes, indeed. But then, of course, we'd been instructed. You see, the instructions kept on coming out that we must. That perhaps there had been an incident in Hanoi or in Yen Bay or some part of the country, and so it came to notice, shall we say, something to come to notice, and then once more the colonel would stick out instructions saying how careful we had to be in our associations.
Okay. Now, these people like the Spaniards and the Jews that were there, how are they fitting into Indochina after this terrible voyage?
No, I mean, they were legionnaires, and so, you know, they tried to do their best, and we, who were the elite, if you like, we realized that they were trying to do their best, and that if we could help them on occasions, then there's no reason. But as I said, you see, here I am in the office, the material office in Via 3.
Right.
I didn't get out with the companies. I was never out on the 3rd Battalion or the 1st Battalion. And it was only in 1943, you know, when there was a, when I was moved, when the military school, the military academy, was organized. Okay. Or resuscitated, if you like.
Right. Just describe, what were the living conditions there like? I mean, in terms of electric power and plumbing and all the rest of it.
Well, I think from time immemorial, the French electrical systems have just been, you know, stick it on the wall and hope for the best. And that was very, very typical of the whole of the buildings in the Legion in Indochina. There was electricity in all the buildings, but it was, you know, to my understanding, quite primitive compared to what we're used to in this country. But we never seemed to have any troubles at all, except that, you know, it was, there were cobwebs, you know, that got behind the wires and all that sort of thing. And then when you were on room duty, you know, you had to get rid of the cobwebs. And there were lots of geckos, lizards, you know, always around the wall. They were friends, really, because, you know, they were after the mosquitoes and flies. And of course, it is definitely mosquito country, and anopheles country. And so malaria, of course, is rife.
Were there many bad cases of malaria?
Oh, very, very often. Very, very bad cases. Eventually, when I came out of Indochina, when I was in Calcutta, I got it. But out there, yes, very, very serious cases. And they were treated as serious.